The French Lieutenant's Woman by John Fowles, dramatised by Graham White, with John Hurt, Emily Bruni, Jonathan Firth, Kelly Riley, and T.P. McKenna. Episode 2.
Need I remind you of our scene? A barn, high above the sea on the Undercliff, a little west of Lyme Regis, one morning in 1867. Charles has gone to this barn against the best advice of Dr. Grogan and possessed with a conviction that Sarah is not mad, that she is, rather, somehow nobler than those around her.
I think you understand what drives me, Mr. Smithson. I'm sure that you do.
Miss Woodruff. Sarah. Control yourself.
I cannot.
Please, we must.
We cannot.
No.
There is someone outside.
Do not fear. It will be Dr. Grogan. He knows all of the situation. Doctor! Sir, what the devil are you doing here?
We're just out walking, Mr. Charles.
I thought I left instructions to...
I've done it, sir. It's all ready. We didn't know, Mr. Charles. Honest, we didn't.
We will walk on, Sam.
Mary, kindly leave me alone with Sam for a moment.
Oh, yes, sir. Certainly, sir.
I have, come here on that business I mentioned.
Yes, sir.
At the request of the physician who is treating her. He is fully aware of the circumstances.
Yes, sir.
Which must on no account be disclosed.
I understand, Mr. Charles.
Here, some money.
No, Mr. Charles, never.
I will make it up to you, but not a word.
On my oath, Mr. Charles.
Miss Woodruff, you must forgive me for taking unpardonable advantage of your unhappy situation. And not only this morning. I have behaved very foolishly. The last thing I wanted was to engage your affections.
The damage is done.
A business calls me to London. I think you should go to Exeter. I beg you, take the money in this purse as a loan, if you wish, until you can find a suitable position. And if you should need further pecuniary assistance...
I shall never see you again.
You cannot expect me to deny that.
Though seeing you is all I live for.
Miss Woodruff!
I accept your loan. With gratitude. I will go to Exeter. And my possessions?
I will see that they are sent to the depot. You may give Mrs. Tranter's name for references. Inform her when you have found a situation.
Thank you.
No. It is I who have to thank you. You are a very remarkable person, Miss Woodruff. I feel deeply ashamed not to have perceived it earlier.
Yes, I am.
We must leave here now.
Yes, thank you.
Now.
I will go first. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Charles, have you been out walking already?
Yes, my dear. I am preoccupied by matters which do not concern you directly.
Fiddlesticks.
I must ask forgiveness. I am not myself. And I fear I have decided I must go to London.
Oh, Charles!
I must deal with my solicitor, Montague, with papers, affairs. And I must inform your father of what has happened. Such a grave alteration in my prospects.
But what is it to him?
I must explain the loss of my title.
I had forgotten that. It was, of course, only for the title that my father was allowing this marriage.
Oh, Tina, I must be scrupulous at this juncture.
Very well. Kiss me, then. Not on the head.
Goodbye, my dear.
My love.
My love.
Now, what of Sarah? What has she chosen to do? Has she left Lyme? Well, let us shift the scene to Exeter, a city which 140 years ago was a great deal further from the capital than it is today. And yes, this is where we find Sarah. at a small establishment known as Endicott's Family Hotel.
It's a 12 and 6, sir. Two rooms, a sitting room, and a bedroom. Here.
Oh, it is quite suitable.
Will you be requiring supper, miss?
No, I have bought a little food also.
Well, I'll leave you to settle yourself. Good evening.
Good evening.
Well, this is most surprising, Charles. Most surprising.
I need hardly add, sir, that this decision of my uncle's comes as a very great surprise to myself as well.
And Ernestina knows?
I bear you a letter from her. Here. Your daughter was, of course, the first I told.
You still have a very fair private income, have you not?
Indeed. I cannot pretend to have been left a pauper.
I shall be very frank with you, my dear Charles. My principal consideration is my daughter's happiness. I shall tell Ernestina that I find her intended even more admirable in adversity than in good fortune. And I think the sooner you return to Lyme, the better it will be.
You do me a great kindness.
Yeah, shake hands.
My pleasure.
Now that that is settled, may I raise with you another matter?
Certainly, sir.
I understand that commerce must seem abhorrent to you. It is not a gentleman's occupation.
It has an essential place in our nation's prosperity.
My store is the largest such establishment in this city. Indeed, in the country. I have no son. You have energy, education, great ability.
But my ignorance of such matters is very nearly total.
Well, Charles, you will never get me to agree that we are all descended from monkeys, but what was it you said about the theory of evolution? A species must change?
In order to survive, it must adapt itself to changes in its environment.
Yes. Then I ask no more than that you give the matter serious thought. Now, Ernestina's mother awaits. Agog for all the latest news from Lyme.
After his conference with Papa and Mama, alone again on a London street, Charles was morosely considering his unavoidable future when out of nowhere an image of Sarah's face and of that kiss came to his mind, stimulating that less than honourable quarter of the Victorian male psyche. So it was that he found himself later in a cab and, rather the worse for wear, searching the streets nearer to his home. Still fighting the influence of Freemanism and still captivated by the image of a lone woman standing clad in black, red-haired. And when he found such a one, beneath a streetlight...
Is it for all night, sir?
Yes.
Pardon me, sir. If you just make yourself at home, I shan't be a minute. It's my little girl, sir. She won't make no noise. Oh, there's a chop house just a step away if you're hungry.
Pray order for yourself if you want. I don't.
Won't you take the chair, sir?
Thank you. The father of your little girl.
Oh, he's not here, sir.
He's working.
He's a soldier, sir.
A soldier?
He's an Indianer.
Ah. Would he not marry you?
He gave me money for when I was brought to bed.
And could you not find other means of livelihood?
Once you've been done wrong to, you've been done wrong to. You have to make out best you can.
You believe this is the best way?
You don't approve, sir?
No, I'm sorry, I'm not feeling quite myself. I don't know your name.
It's Sarah, sir. Oh, sir. Oh, no.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait, I'll get something to clean you up.
No, please. Find me a cab.
I will. I'll not be long.
Oh, no. Be quiet. Your mother will be back soon. Hello. Hush. Look. Look at my watch. See how it gleams in the lamplight?
Oh, Sarah. Did she cry?
Yes, a little. I think she's going back to sleep now.
Oh, the cab's outside.
I feel more myself already. Here. Let your little girl keep my watch.
Oh.
And here.
Oh, sir. Oh, thank you.
You are a brave, kind girl. Come in, Sam. Sam, my apologies for my mood on my return last night. I had a somewhat tiresome evening.
I didn't notice anything, Mr. Charles. Here's your tea and some letters.
Thank you. Now, I will pour it myself. You may go. Grogan. I found no trace of the interested party at the location mentioned. No, indeed, you didn't. And the second... an address. Matches. And now, we burn into the air. Sam!
Mr. Charles?
I have completed my business, Sam. We return to Lyme tomorrow. See to the tickets. Oh, and take that message on my desk to the telegraph office.
Yes, sir. Is there something burning, Mr. Charles?
No. Go along, quickly. Well, why are you standing there?
Mr. Charles?
What is it?
I'm going to ask for Mary's hand.
Are you indeed?
Yes, sir.
Well?
And if I marry, I shall have to live out. I've been thinking of going into business, sir.
Business? What business?
A little shop. Drapers and haberdashers, Mr. Charles. But I've only put down £30.
Sam, once you take ideas above your station, well, then you will have nothing but unhappiness. No, I'm used to you. I'm damned if I want to lose you. I'm fond of you, man.
Well, your feelings are reciprocated, sir. With respect.
Well, then, we're happy with each other. Let's continue that way. And do spare me the whipped dog. You shall be well provided for when you're married. But the truth is, I visited my uncle because he is himself getting married.
I had no idea, Mr. Charles.
It makes for a change in my condition, Sam. But when I am married, circumstances will be easier. You will say nothing of this?
No, Mr. Charles. I know how to keep a secret.
Good. Now, prepare for the journey.
Our employer doesn't seem quite himself, Sam.
You're right, Mrs. Rogers. He's not. He has had news.
Has he?
He has. A change to his circumstances. That's one matter, and I know of another. Letters are flying, Mrs. Rogers.
What do you know?
Well, that I cannot say. But he was blind drunk last night.
I wouldn't have believed it possible.
There's lots yours truly wouldn't have believed possible, Mrs. R. As has happened all the same, oh yes.
He never wants to cry off.
Your wild horses wouldn't part my lips, Mrs. Rogers. But I think you might be sharp. Very sharp. And I bet £1,000 that we shall spend the night in Exeter tomorrow. Now, do you have that kettle steaming again?
You're not going to...
In the circumstances, Mrs. Rogers, I most certainly am.
Exeter Central Station! Exeter Central!
Here, boy. How'd you like to earn yourself tuppence?
Yes, sir.
Grab these ear bags and find us a trolley for it. Go on.
Dan, how was your journey?
Oh, decent enough, thank you, Mr. Charles. Your own?
Slightly irksome. I'm not sure that first class counts for much in this day and age.
Are we to stay the night in the city, Mr. Charles?
No. No, a carriage. A four-wheeler, it looks like rain.
Oh, well, yes, sir. Very well, Mr. Charles.
I will be in the bar at the station hotel for some refreshment. We shall make on in 20 minutes.
Right. Boy, have you ever lost yourself a £1,000 bet?
No, sir.
Well, I have. And for this one time, well, I'm more than happy to. Here's sixpence for you. Now, find us that carriage. Quick shot.
Come in.
My dear Ernestina.
Charles!
I forgot to buy flowers in Exeter.
So I see, sir.
I was in such haste to get here before you went to bed. Now, let me see what you're embroidering for your secret admirer. What is it?
It is a watch pocket, of course.
And what an irony. I have just now lost my watch. Well, in that case, we shall walk out tomorrow, and I shall buy a new one, and we shall...
Charles, what did Father say?
Father was most civilized. And now I wish tomorrow were our wedding day.
Oh, Charles.
Dearest, everything is resolved, and we may permit ourselves a little glimpse of our future happiness.
You will never guess at the degree of my relief. It has been torture.
Well, at this moment, you only need contemplate the torture of marriage to me.
Well, that will be a minor burden.
Now, I have a small confession to make. It concerns that miserable female from Marlborough House.
Not poor tragedy.
I fear the more vulgar appellation is better suited. It really is most stupid and trivial. What happened was merely this. During one of my little pursuits of those elusive fossils, I was walking along the undercliff just by the beach there.
And now, do you hear? My watch has stopped. And of its own accord, not my doing. It is a beautiful piece, but somewhat temperamental. It was handed down from my great-great-grandmother, who was herself given it as a child by a kind gentleman. Yes, it is the same watch. And now I move it on again. Do you hear? Somehow it ticks more quickly. And time moves forward. The wash of the waters in Lyne Bay. A metaphor, perhaps? The sea of life? You see, our story is ended. What happened to Sarah, I do not know. But she never troubled Charles in person again. She sank out of sight, as people do. Charles and Ernestina did not live happily ever after, but they lived together. Charles outlasting her by a decade, and they begat, what shall it be, 7 children? Charles' uncle begat twins, and so Charles went into the Freeman business. He was bored at first, and then got a taste for the thing. His sons took it over, and the family still runs their vast shop in its empire today. Sam and Mary. Oh, but who can be bothered with the biography of servants in a story such as this? They married, bred, and died in the manner of their kind. And now, having brought this story to a thoroughly traditional end, I had better confess. It did not quite happen the way I have been leading you to believe. We are all storytellers. That is, we all have a habit of creating fictional futures for ourselves. Charles was no exception. What you have just now heard is not what happened, but rather what he spent the hours on the train between London and Exeter imagining might happen. You see, he had already decided to go through with his marriage. But that 3-word letter he had received from Sarah and burnt in the grate of his London bedroom had a disturbing effect on him and on his decision. It obsessed him. It presented him with a very debilitating case of the anxiety of freedom. And the consequence was... Listen, I take this watch and turn it back. And we leave Lyne Bay and Charles' imagined Exeter and find in its place the real one.
Exeter Central Station! Exeter Central!
Are we to stay the night in the city, Mr. Charles?
Yes. Yes, I fancy it will rain. We'll put up at the ship, and I think after that confounded train journey, I will stretch my legs. Do you go with the baggage?
With respect, Mr. Charles, I wouldn't, not with those rain clothes up there about to break.
A little rain won't hurt me.
Right you are, Mr. Charles. Shall I give orders for dinner?
I'll see when I come in. I may attend evensong at the cathedral.
Yeah, boy, have you ever won £1,000 bet?
No, sir.
Well, I have. And it's no pleasure, I can tell you. There. Here's a penny.
You said tuppence.
I said a penny. And find me a carriage to Endicott's family hotel.
Good afternoon. I wish to speak with one of your... Miss Woodruff.
Oh, the poor young lady. She was coming downstairs the day before yesterday, and she slipped, sir, and turned her ankle. Something horrible. Swole up, she says.
Then I cannot see her.
Oh, bless me, you can go up, sir. It will raise her spirits. You'll be a relative, I dare say.
Well, I have to see her on a business matter.
Ah, a... gentleman of the law?
Yes.
Then you must go up, sir. May I take your card? No? Well, follow me, please. Miss Woodruff!
Come in.
There is a gentleman.
Oh, thank you, Mrs. Endicott.
I was passing through Exeter.
I see.
Had I not better go at once and fetch a doctor?
Please, no. He would only advise me to sit and rest as I am already.
You are not in pain?
No.
Imagine if this had happened on the undercliff.
Yes.
Perhaps I should...
No. Please. Sit down. Forgive me, I did not expect you.
You have communicated your address to Mrs. Tranter?
No.
Only to me?
Yes.
That is what I have come to discuss. Oh, my dear Miss Woodruff, pray, don't cry. I should not have come. I meant not to.
I thought never to see you again.
Oh, Sarah. Sarah.
There is a bedroom.
I will carry you there. We must not. We must not. This is madness.
We must.
Oh, dearest, my dearest, my sweetest angel. Sarah, Sarah. Oh, Sarah. I am worse than a Frenchman.
No, never.
What is to become of us?
I cannot think beyond this hour.
I must break my engagement.
No. I ask nothing of you. I am to blame.
You are not. You warned me. I knew when I came here what might happen, and I chose to be blind. I am infinitely strange to myself.
I feel that too.
We must be together, Sarah.
No. I'm not fit to be your wife.
But I no longer love her.
She is worthy of you. I am not.
But you cannot mean that I should go away, as if nothing had happened between us.
Why not if I love you? I have long imagined such a day as this. But all I wish for is your happiness.
But what? The landlady downstairs. And my man is waiting for me at my hotel. I beg you, give me 2 days' grace. I cannot think what to do now.
You must not do anything. I am not worthy of you.
I beg you, we must talk further about this, but at this moment I need to secure the situation. Wait there a moment. Allow me to collect myself. My breeches. Where am I? Blood. On my shirt? Have I cut myself? But how?
I told you. I am not worthy.
The Frenchman. You never...
No. When I went to where he stayed in Weymouth, I saw him come out with a woman. When they had gone, I walked away.
Why did you...
I shall not trouble you again.
What have I... Why should
there
you...
There is one thing in which I have not deceived you. I loved you. But it cannot be. And now you must dress yourself.
I demand an explanation.
I cannot explain. It is not to be explained.
It must be.
No, it is as you said. I, too, am infinitely strange to myself. Please go now. I pray for your happiness. You cannot marry me, Mr. Smithson.
But all I ask is to be allowed to understand...
It cannot be. I beseech you. Please leave.
Forgive me, O Lord, for my selfishness. Forgive me for breaking thy laws. Forgive me my dishonor. Forgive me my unchastity. Forgive and advise me, O Lord, in my travail. But I know this to be futile.
Sir, you are quite well.
Yes, thank you. A little confused.
I can be of no assistance.
Where would I begin?
Begin with what you have done, my friend.
I have broken a sacred vow, a betrothal. It was broken for a love which has proved itself groundless.
Ah, then you know your choice. Duty, honor, self-respect. That vow which is broken must be mended.
Observe my duty and I will be comfortably safe, or embrace my freedom and be crucified each moment.
Do not take his crucifixion in vain. He hangs there to redeem our sins.
And yet, I know of one, a woman, who would reject that hanging man. Allow him to be taken down by living men and women, who would uncrucify him.
You are tormented indeed, in need of your God.
No. I know of whom I am in need. I have been, while still alive, as if dead, a very fossil. But now I see another world, a new reality, a freedom. She and I in Paris, Florence, Rome.
The one with whom you have broken.
No. Oh, no. The one with whom I have sinned. Thank you. Thank you. And your faith. Sam.
Yes, Mr. Charles.
I wish you to take this letter to the address on the envelope.
Endicott's Family Hotel.
It is in Bartholomew Street, at the end of 4th Street.
Is it, sir?
Yes, it is. Now wait 10 minutes to see if there is an answer. If there is none, I expect none, but wait just in case, come straight back here and hire a fast carriage. We go to Lyme. But no baggage. We return here tonight.
Tonight? Back to Exeter? But I thought we were...
Never mind what you thought. Just do as I say.
Yes, Mr. Charles.
Who is it, Mary?
It's Mr. Smithson, miss.
Well, send him in, then. What is all this ceremony? Charles, I received a letter from Papa this morning telling me all that you had discussed. Charles? Is something wrong, Charles?
I beg you to sit down.
But what has happened? Why do you look at me like that?
Because I do not know how to say what I must. Please, sit down.
Papa,
he was kindness itself. But I did not tell him the truth.
The truth? What truth?
That I have, after many hours of the deepest and most painful consideration, come to the conclusion that I am not worthy of you.
Charles, you are playing.
To my eternal shame, I am not.
Well, this is some nightmare. But you forget your telegram.
It was sent before my decision.
But...
Ernestina, please listen to me. I have always had the greatest respect and affection for you. But I have always been shamefully aware that a part of my regard for you was ignoble. I saw an opportunity of an advantageous marriage.
I cannot believe it is you I hear speaking.
I liked you very much. I sincerely believed that that liking would grow into love.
It is some cruel imposter.
What has haunted me is the injustice I should be doing you by marrying you without that love you deserve. If you and I were different people. But we are not. We know by a look, a word, whether our love is returned.
I thought we knew.
My dear Ernestina.
I am not your dear.
A love feigned is like a false faith. One can pretend to have belief, but the pretense will finally out.
May I speak now?
Of course.
I did not choose you because I was so innocent that I could not make comparison between you and 100 other men I had been dangled before. You seemed more generous, wiser, more experienced. You speak of faith. I wrote in my journal after our engagement that you seem to have so little faith in yourself. You believe yourself a failure. Faith in yourself is what I wish to make my real bridal gift to you.
Then you remind me of how much I lose.
But only yesterday that telegram you sent me told me of your joy. You are lying. Something has happened since you sent it.
I wish to spare you, but yes. You do not know her. Her name is unimportant. I have known her many years. I thought the attachment broken. I discovered in London that it is not.
I suppose she has pretensions to birth. Oh, if only I had listened to my poor dear father. He knows the nobility, fine manners and unpaid bills. What woman could be so vile as to make a man break his vows?
I will not discuss
this. Where is she now? In London?
Yes.
Then go to her. My father will drag your name, both your names, through the mire. You will be spurned and detested by all who know you. You will be hounded out of England. You will be... Oh, I am faint.
Mary! Your mistress has had a shock. You are on no account to leave her.
Ma'am.
I go to fetch Dr. Grogan.
Ma'am. Miss? Ma'am.
She is recovered.
I put her to sleep. I told Mrs. Chatter to have her watch day and night, to treat her as an invalid, if she wishes it, to humour her. She's young, in excellent health. In 6 months, she may be as gay as a linnet.
She said nothing?
No, Mrs. Tranter said all that was necessary. She described you as a monster.
I see. Miss Woodruff is not what you think, Grogan. I am certain of that. I did not reject your advice without much heart-searching.
Smithson, a gentleman remains a gentleman when he rejects advice. He does not do so when he tells lies.
I believed them necessary.
As you believed the satisfaction of your lust necessary?
Would you then have me live a lifetime of pretense?
I would have had you think twice before you embroiled that innocent girl in your pursuit of self-knowledge. You will marry the other?
That is my sincere intent.
She knows, I take it. You have told her?
Yes.
And she has accepted your offer, of course?
I have every reason to believe so. She has received a message confirming my intentions, delivered this morning by my man.
Who, no doubt, has the measure of the whole affair by now.
I trust Sam as I trust you.
Smithson, I know you wouldn't have done what you have unless you believed Miss Woodruff's own account of her extraordinary behaviour. I warn you that a doubt must remain, one which must cast a shadow over any future protection you extend to her.
I have taken that into consideration. I am far more to blame. She merely sent me her address.
Honest, at least. If, by your pursuit of some higher sense of self than this, you become a better and a more generous human being, you may be forgiven. But if not, you are doubly damned.
My conscience has said to me as much.
And if you do not leave here within the hour, I shall be at your hotel with the largest horsewhip I can find.
Sam, find us a carriage for Exeter at once. Sam?
We're in a hurry to leave, are we, sir?
Yes, we are, man. A damned hurry.
Do you intend to tell me why, sir?
Damn it, Sam. How dare you be so impertinent? I have just broken off my engagement to Miss Freeman.
Oh, no, sir.
Were you at the house?
Yes.
Well, then, keep your mouth shut about it.
Mrs. Tranter has agreed to provide for me and Mary.
Mrs. Tranter?
In the circumstances, I'm leaving your employ. As I ought to have done already.
Go to the devil.
I don't fancy anywhere, sir, that I might meet a friend of yours. If you wish for attention, pray ring for one of the hotel domestics.
Wait here, my man.
Yes, sir.
Yes?
Good evening, Mrs. Endicott.
Oh, it's you, sir.
Miss Woodruff expects me. I'll find my own way.
But the young lady's left, sir. She took the London train this morning.
Did she leave an address?
No, sir.
Any message left for me?
I thought it likely it was you she was going off with, sir. That's what I took the liberty to presume.
Well, here is my card. If you hear from her, if you would let me know. Without fail. Here, something for the service and postage.
Oh, thank you, sir. Without fail.
The one thing. This morning, a manservant, did he not come with a letter for Miss Woodruff? Shortly after 8 o'clock?
No, sir, no one came.
I see. Good night.
The station. At once.
Which train, sir?
The London Night Mail.
Yes, Charles has administered some shocks. And now, well, he receives some. He arrived at the station in ridiculously good time and sat impatiently waiting for the train to start. At last, a whistle sounded, and Charles thought he had won the solitude he craved, until at the last minute a face appeared at the window. The latecomer muttered a "Pardon me, sir," and sat at the far end of the compartment, a man of 40 or so, bearded, greying, and rather aggressively secure, like an ambitious butler or a successful lay preacher. Charles fell asleep. After a while, his new companion began to stare at him, and the stare went on and on. It became positively cannibalistic in its intensity, questioning, asking, "How could I use you? What could I do with you?" It was the look of an omnipotent god, but one of a mean and dubious quality. A familiar look to me, and I will keep up the pretense no longer. The question I am asking, as I stare at Charles, is, what the devil am I going to do with you? My problem is simple. What Charles wants is clear, but what the protagonist of this story wants is not. And I am not at all sure where she is at the moment. As we near London, I continue to stare at Charles and see no reason this time to fix the fight upon which he is about to engage. Though the only way I can take no part in it is to show two versions. But so strong is the tyranny of ending that whichever comes last will feel like the real one. So I take a purse from the pocket of my coat, I extract a coin, I rest it on my right thumbnail, and I flick it spinning into the air and catch it in my left hand. So be it. The train has arrived at Paddington. Charles disembarks. The bearded man from his carriage has disappeared into the throng. Some weeks pass, during which Charles employs a firm of private investigators to search the governess agencies, educational boards, lodging houses of London. No success. In the meantime, he receives a letter requiring him to attend the chambers of Mr. Freeman's solicitor, accompanied by his own solicitor, Montague.
Here's your medicine, Charles. And I'm afraid you've got to take it, dear boy.
Yes, I know.
You best to read it.
Really? Though I've no alternative but to sign, if I want to avoid open court.
Read it, Charles.
I entered upon a clandestine liaison with a person named Sarah Emily Woodruff. By it I have forever forfeited the right to be considered a gentleman.
Oh, the very harshness of this as it stands will argue for you. But you must sign.
Very well. There's one thing, Harry. I wish I knew how Ernestina is.
She is as well as can be expected. Those were the lawyer's words.
I wish I were dead.
What will you do now, Charles?
I will go abroad.
And so he did. And I'd pity any detective ordered to dog Charles through the next 20 months. Almost every city in Europe received Charles. once, but rarely for long. He saw the pyramids, the Holy Land, Greece, Sicily, but all unseen. In 19 months, he did not return home. Montague continued to search. Nothing. And then, one day, back in London, Mary, that young woman who had once been at Ernestina's beck and call, was walking independent now with her new baby in an admittedly far from fashionable area, Chelsea. She was still fairly new to the city, still prone to being surprised by its scale and its goings-on. So she was astonished when she saw, quite by chance, a figure she recognized from her former West Country life. An elusive, red-haired figure slipping in through the front door of a grandish house in this not-so-grand neighborhood.
Well, I'm blowed.
And she told her husband, a Londoner, who now worked as an assistant in a large West End store. And he, though still of the opinion that a gentleman's gentleman may prove superior in all moral respects to the gentleman he serves, felt a pang of conscience. For Sam had risen high in Mr. Freeman's employment as a result of his telling the whole story of Charles' dishonorable behavior. And yet, now, after such a time, he felt compelled to pass on Mary's sighting and to put to rest his former master's agony. Which he did. Anonymously. And so it came to be that Charles received in a Lisbon hotel a telegram from Montague. Three words again. But this time,
she is found.
Let me set the watch once more. It is 20 months later, the very last day of May, 1869. Charles, a thin, tired-looking Charles, approaches a house in Chelsea. He's not smiling. He knocks at the door. What will he find?
Good day, madam. Forgive my hesitation. I expected to see someone else.
A maid? We do not have such a thing here.
Oh, indeed. I wish to speak to a Mrs. Ruffwood. I believe she resides here.
Your name, if you please.
Here is my card. Pray tell her I've come a very long way to see her.
Who is it, Emily?
This gentleman wishes to see Sarah.
Yes?
If you would be so good, sir. It is a private matter. I knew her well before she came to London.
Is she,
I think they are talking, that is all.
Then take him up, my dear.
Thank you. Mrs. Ruffwood is employed here as a governess.
Oh, she is no longer a governess.
Oh. I thought you said they're talking. I presumed her charges.
No. Kindly wait in here. She is with the gentleman of the house, but I believe her work is finished.
Her work?
Yes. Mr. Rossetti is an artist.
Mr. Rossetti?
Yes.
Yes, he is. An artist, of course. And the man downstairs?
His brother. We are a household of artists.
And these images?
That one is a portrait of Sarah. Please, wait here.
Of course. My God, what folly. To assume that a fallen woman must keep on falling. And that I am come to arrest the law of gravity.
Mr. Smithson.
Miss Woodruff.
How came you here? The address?
My solicitor was told you lived here, I presume, by you. Did you not know?
I'm sorry if I appear ignorant of your circumstances, but I truly am. I will be honest with you, I am at a loss, taken completely by surprise.
I broke my engagement to Miss Freeman.
You broke it?
Yes, soon after we last spoke. I see you are well.
Life has been kind to me.
That gentleman in there, this house belongs to him?
Yes. I am his amanuensis, his assistant.
But you serve as his model?
Sometimes.
I see. And this is a sketch of you?
Your tone is accusatory.
I do not mean it to be. And Rossetti knows you are not married.
I pass as a widow.
I believe his wife is dead, by her own hand.
She is dead, but not in his heart.
These are hardly the circumstances I expected.
I lack eloquence.
Mr. Smithson, this is not some house of satyrs.
I'd feel cumbersome in this place. And with you. I see in you a freedom I can barely comprehend. I sent you a note. That very night in Exeter. It made a proposal. Acceptance I took to be a signal that you wished me to proceed with my break away from all I knew, that you wished for me. I was betrayed by a faithless wretch of a servant. The letter was not delivered. And you never knew.
No.
And what I say means nothing to you?
It means very much to me. So much,
I beg you to continue.
I do not know what to say, simply.
You told me then that you loved me. You gave me the greatest proof a woman can, that what possessed us was no ordinary degree of mutual sympathy and attraction.
I do not deny that.
But you have found newer and more pressing affections.
I did not think ever to see you again.
That does not answer my question.
Mr. Smithson, I am not his mistress.
Then I do not know how to interpret your very evident embarrassment at seeing me again.
Mr. Smithson, there was a falsehood in what was between us.
I was not to blame for that.
I've since seen artists destroy work that might seem to the amateur perfectly good. I was told that if an artist is not their own sternest judge, they are not fit to be an artist.
I was 1,000 miles from here when the news that you had been found came to me. You cannot answer me with observations, however apposite, on art.
They were intended to apply to life.
Then
as
what
well.
You are saying is that you have never loved me.
I could not say that.
But you must. You must say I was totally evil. I never saw in him anything other than an instrument I could use, for now I don't care that he still loves me, that in all his travels he has not seen a woman to compare to me. You must say I do not care that his crime was to have shown a few hours indecision.
But I do not wish to marry. I do not want to share my life. Mr. Smithson, I am happy.
I too have changed. I have learned much of myself. I make no conditions. All that Miss Sarah Woodruff is, Mrs. Charles Smithson may continue to be.
No. I am not to be understood.
You forget that you have said that to me before. Have you thought much of me in my absence?
To begin with. And 6 months later, when I first saw the notices you had placed.
Then you did know.
And which obliged me to change my lodgings and name. I knew you had not married Miss Freeman.
Then you have not only ruined my life, you have taken pleasure in it.
I knew nothing but unhappiness would come from such a meeting.
I think you lie. I think you revelled in the thought of my misery.
You misjudge me.
No, it is as I say. You have not only planted the dagger in my breast, you have delighted in twisting it. A day will come when you will be called to account for what you have done to me. And if there is justice in heaven, your punishment shall outlast eternity.
I cannot let you go believing that. Please. There is a lady in this house who knows me, understands me better than anyone else in the world. She wishes to see you. I beg you to let her do so. She will explain.
I am astounded that you think a stranger to me could extenuate your behaviour.
She is waiting. She knows you are here.
I do not care if it is the Queen herself. I will not see her.
I shall not be present.
Stand aside.
No.
Let go of my arm. What am I to understand by this?
What a less honourable man might have guessed some time ago. She will come at once. I beg you to listen to what she has to say, and to accord her the respect due to her situation and age.
What a less honourable man might have guessed. Another woman? What new enormity is this? A woman? Rossetti's sister? Christina?
Miss Ruffwood has left.
Yes. She gave me to understand a female wishes to have a few words in private with me. She is called for.
I see. Now, sit there on the floor, my dear.
I'm sorry, this is a private matter of some importance. I trust this person will come very shortly.
She is come.
You? It is you. Yes, you. Here.
She has introduced herself.
Only partly. What is her name?
Lalage.
It is Greek. From Lalagio. To babble like a brook.
I know.
Yes. But why? What if I had never...
Had to be so.
And all those cruel words you spoke forced me to speak an answer.
Had to be spoken.
Shall I never understand your parables?
There, an ending. For Charles and for Sarah and for Lalage. And a happy one too. Hard-earned, hard-won redemption, and a feeling that the good things have triumphed and the bad things have been vanquished, even if some misery has been caused along the way. After all, where is Ernestina at this moment? Yet, while all this has been going on inside the house, a new figure has appeared outside. Tall, bearded, leaning against the parapet of the embankment across the way from 16 Cheney Walk, the mid-19th century residence of Mr. Dante Gabriel Rossetti, noted poet, painter, and in the eyes of Victorian society, decadent. This man looks like our friend from the train, but somehow more self-aggrandizing, more flashy, even less sympathetic than before. One has the impression he can hardly contain his amusement at the scene. He evidently regards the world as his to possess and use as he likes. But now he straightens, businesslike. He takes out his watch and makes a small adjustment to the time. It seems that he was running a quarter of an hour fast. Now he beckons peremptorily with his cane toward an open carriage that waits some 100 yards away. The man mounts and sits, leaning back expansively. And the equipage draws briskly away from the house, while within the dwelling...
I think you lie. I think you revel in the thought of my misery.
You misjudge me.
No, it is as I say. You've not only planted the dagger in my breast, you've delighted in twisting it. A day will come when you shall be called to account for what you have done to me. And if there is justice in heaven, your punishment shall outlast eternity.
Mr. Smithson, is this not proof that we had better never to have set eyes on each other again?
Your logic assumes I knew your real nature. I did not.
Are you sure?
I thought your mistress in Lyme a selfish and bigoted woman. I now perceive she was a saint compared to her companion.
And should I not be selfish if I, knowing I cannot love you as a wife must, said that you may marry me?
There was a time when you spoke of me as your last resource, as your one remaining hope in life. Our situations are now reversed. You have no time for me. Very well. Why do you smile?
Can you not see? A solution exists. You said you had changed.
A solution?
Yes.
What? That I become the secret butt of this corrupt house? The pet donkey? Smirked at and satirized for my starched old ways?
Are we not now truly revealed to one another?
You knew I would refuse. Goodbye. Forever.
Sir, you're leaving.
Get out of my way.
And so, I now let the watch wind down. You remember the coin was tossed. The tyranny of an ending decided. You may think that not to accept Sarah's offer was Charles' final foolishness. You may think that she was right, that her battle for territory was a legitimate uprising against the perennial invader. But what you must not think is that this is a less plausible ending to their story. The river of life flows past a deserted embankment. And now along this other deserted riverside, Charles begins to pace. No soul to be seen. Only in the distance a trotting carriage which has turned out of sight by the time he reaches the parapet. He walks into his own oblivion? No. Whatever the bitterness of the moment, he has at last found an atom of faith in himself on which to build, and at last realized that life is to be, however inadequately, emptily, hopelessly, into the city's iron heart, endured. And out again, upon the unplumbed, salt, estranging sea.
In The French Lieutenant's Woman by John Fowles, the narrator was John Hurt. Charles was played by Jonathan Firth. Ernestina by Kelly Riley. Sarah, Emily Bruni. Mrs. Endicott, Susan Jameson. Sam, Nick Sace. Dr. Grogan, T.P. McKenna. Mr. Freeman, Jared McDermott. The Curate, John Cummins. Montague, Wayne Foskett. Mary, Ella Smith. The Prostitute, Sophie Roberts. And Mrs. Rogers, Colleen Prendergast. The French Lieutenant's Woman was dramatised by Graham White. The director was Peter Kavanagh.